Hello and welcome back to Security Insights, the podcast that takes a deeper look at today's most important issues in cybersecurity and beyond. I'm Stephen Pritchard, editor and presenter. In this episode, I'm pleased to welcome back a previous guest, Trevor Deering. Trevor is Director of Critical Infrastructure at Illumio. Regular listeners might recall that he was last on the show talking about the cyber threats to healthcare providers, and in particular, to the NHS. But risks to healthcare are just part of a wider threat landscape, where we're seeing all forms of critical national infrastructure being targeted by a growing band of bad actors. From nation states to criminal groups, or even those with more of a political axe to grind. Trevor's work is increasingly focused on resilience and helping organizations to survive and recover from attacks. And this is becoming more of a priority for firms and their boards, and of course for regulators and governments. First though, I asked Trevor to set out how the threats to national infrastructure are changing. What are the attackers trying to achieve? And what do we need to defend against?
The conversation we have the most really is about disruptive attacks, so keeping the lights on. So I think that with the shift slightly away from trying to sell a lot of records online and the cost of that, the revenue from that's gone down. A lot of the cyber criminals, plus also probably state actors, are targeting disrupting attacks. So we saw, a year ago, the attack on the post office and, the costs of that roll on and on. So whatever it was, $12 million now or pounds or whatever it happens to be. And so there is a concern about the ability to keep the lights on, the water flowing, manufacturing working, the finance sector still operating. And so, so those conversations becoming much, much about how do we survive an attack rather than, trying to stop everything, really.
And what does a disruptive attack look like in simple terms?
It can manifest itself in different ways. I guess the most extreme, and, this has been dramatized in TV programs, so we've seen Cobra and we've seen Trigger Point and all sorts of things, would be a direct attack on things like a super transformer, which could black out, half the country. Things like that at one end. But at the other end, it's just we saw an attack on a food company last year where basically they disrupted the logistics, so they weren't able to deliver what they were, they were meant to. And so they were able to extort money from them in that way. So it can manifest itself in really quite severe issues or very, very targeted ones.
And are we seeing this then as intentionally aiming to extort? So are these extortion-based attacks in the way that, say, ransomware is around data capture and locking out data, or are they more, say, politically motivated?
There's an it depends on that. So I think there's a lot of that extortion. So in the, the IBM cost of a breach report that came out for 2023, there was a stat in there that the extortion has taken over ransomware as the, as the primary attack vector. And the whole concept of trying to, extort as much money as possible is more predictable potentially than stealing and trying to sell data, because once you get on the open market, you don't know what the price is going to be. But the negotiation process can be quite severe. And so organizations end up paying tens of millions of pounds to these organizations to get their processes back. And they don't always, that doesn't always happen. So a lot of companies never ever recover back to where they, where they were in the first place.
So are they paying over money to not be attacked, or are they paying money for the attack to be turned off?
Yeah, mostly for the attack to be turned off. I think that the challenge is that a lot of people assume that as soon as the attack's turned off, everything gets back to normal. But the cost of actually recovering can be quite substantial. And, for each of these attacks, there's generally a report because, there always is. It's, critical infrastructure. And there's a series of recommendations. And And this has been happening for years. And it does make you wonder sometimes why a lot of those recommendations aren't followed. So, you know, I think there is a challenge that we face in the focus that people and politicians and society has on this type of attack. Because, you know, a lot of people understand there's a ransomware attack, it gets locked up, things are sold. But I don't think there is enough awareness in general of the potential for an extortion attack. And I think, you know, when we saw what came out of the government select committee on ransomware, and they spoke about, you know, a 1.9% degrade in GDP, it's almost, you know, COVID levels of impact that a severe attack could have.
What's intriguing here is that they have sufficient access to critical systems to pretty much switch them on and off at will.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, that's an interesting one, because the challenges are within a lot of that infrastructure. You're not dealing with traditional IT. You're dealing with quite legacy OT sort of environments. So a lot of these things have to have a very long life. So think about a transformer or a substation has to have a very long life. And there's not enough, separation or control over what is able to communicate with that. And so because of that, the attackers are very, very sophisticated. They can use AI type tools to understand what their routes are into the organization, how to reach some of these critical assets. And because of that, it becomes, you know, increasingly difficult to protect against it. And a lot of the time, the key is doing very, very basic things. It's, you know, it's understanding what the risk is, understanding what is communicating with what, it's putting in the barriers to prevent that happening. Because, you know, you can't put EDR or something onto an old bit of OT. So you've got to mitigate the risk as a, you know, in slightly different ways.
And how widespread are these attacks? Because I'm not seeing as many or hearing of as many as we hear of ransomware at the moment.
No, that's true. I mean, there was a recently a major attack in Denmark where there was a vulnerability in a firewall product that a lot of utilities were using in Denmark. And there was a sustained attack through that by probably three or four different ransomware groups. And there is an extremely good report that I'd recommend everyone sort of download from the Danish sector, sir. And basically the operators got the CERT involved early on, and they were able to repel that attack, but probably only just. And so we don't hear of these attacks, but a lot of the time, if they take place and we repel them, you know, only one thing has to go wrong before it becomes a successful attack. And I think, you know, far too often, again, some of the basics aren't in place. And some of that is funding, some of that is investment. You know, I think, you know, the cost of putting, you know, if it costs £1 million to put some of these protection in place, the ability to then not have to spend £10 million on recovering is, you know, is quite a thing. But it's a difficult set of maths to deal with, especially if you're in public sector. So if you're a local council, you've got very little money to start with, and then trying to decide how to spend that and whether to spend that on cybersecurity becomes really, really difficult. So I think there is so much risk and danger out there, and partly because cybersecurity doesn't win votes and we're in an election year, it's, you know, it may get yet pushed down further down the agenda.
Is that part of the problem facing the CNI sector, though, overall? Because it is that mix of public and private ownership, which is quite hard for organisations to navigate through. So if you're a public sector body, you can't simply offset the cost of investing in cybersecurity and say, well, that enables us to enter new markets or digitise our products or whatever. It's just seen as a cost in a lot of cases, particularly where, let's say, there's more state ownership. The UK is quite unusual in things like water and electricity being entirely in the private sector, with the notable exception, I must say, notable exception of water being publicly owned in Scotland.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because if you know, for a privately owned electricity or water company, you can legislate and say to them, you must do this. You must embed security in everything you do. And if you don't do that, if there's an incident, we'll give you a big fine. So that's, and then it's beholden on the owner of that organization to invest, you know, as they need. I think it's more difficult with public sector because there is so many pulls on the public purse. You know, social care, you know, there was a stat, I think, where they local council said, well, we spend 75% of all our money on social care. It's much more difficult for those organizations to then do an invest. Same with NHS trusts, same with, you know, whatever it happens to be. And again, cybersecurity investment doesn't win votes. And I think that was one of the conclusions from that select committee was that successive, you know, ministers and people within government haven't necessarily put enough focus on this, even though there is this huge risk of impact. So I think it's much more difficult for the public sector than potentially the private sector.
You mentioned that a lot of these systems are quite old and they're not part of conventional IT, so they sit within the operational technology sphere. How much of a problem is that for organisations when it comes to actually understanding where the risk is? And is your perception that risk has increased because, say, these systems are not new, so presumably the change is that more people are either able to attack them or willing to attack them?
With that, there's some transition going on. So, you know, we hear about smart factories, smart grids, all this sort of thing. So within potentially the electricity grid, the need to balance the delivery and the supply of electricity, because, you know, that with electric vehicles and things, that balance is sort of shifting. To monitor all that, they need to be much smarter. So, you know, so we're starting to see next generation substations and next generation infrastructure that is a lot more sophisticated and looks a lot more like IT. So instead of there being discrete individual, you know, things running Windows XP that just pull a lever or something like this, we're starting to see sort of virtualized, ruggedized servers running multiple applications or containerized environments or, you know, or these sort of things. And so that sort of creates a new problem because they carry all the vulnerabilities and things that you would expect in those environments. So you do need to make sure that you're protecting each of those applications and separating each of those applications from each other, even though they're potentially sitting on the same platform. And you start to see things like wind turbines and, you know, a lot of, I guess, the new sort of renewable energy is much smarter as well. So, you know, if you have solar panels on your roof, you potentially can sell the electricity back to the grid. And that means connecting into the smart infrastructure in the grid. So you get something called the grid edge. And so all of these areas become either potential targets for attack or ways of penetrating the grid, or, you know, they create enough uncertainty and danger and risk within the infrastructure to cause those problems. So again, it does come back to thinking, okay, when we're changing, we're getting smarter, we need to think about a security strategy for that. And that could be zero trust, that could be NIST, that could be, you know, whatever it happens to be. As long as there is one, then I think we're in a good shape.
So part of the issue is then layering on the new functionality which people want, so the smart technology to give it a shorthand, and then that's introduced vulnerabilities.
Potentially, yes. Yes, I think you've sort of taken away with one hand. So as you take away the Windows 7 machines that are just, you know, Windows XP and full of vulnerabilities, and you're putting in much smarter things. But the good news is that actually these new systems can be patched. So they're architected differently. There is a thought in there that to try and prevent us getting to that legacy issue again in a few years of having applications that sit on containers or, you know, however it happens to be.
But one issue in particular, if you look at energy, but it's not just energy, is that these systems are actually quite, the phrase I've heard used is brittle. You know, it doesn't take a lot to disrupt a whole network. And that's part of the issue that we've got, that bad actors, you know, they don't need to attack every substation. Like you said, they only need to attack effectively one super transformer to cause a massive impact. And that leads us on to the wider question of systems resilience and redundancy, because again, the whole move, if you go back to manufacturing, the move towards just-in-time, it doesn't take a lot to mean your processes don't work anymore, because things that were meant to be there in time are simply not. And that was the example you alluded to from, I think it was Denmark, wasn't it?
You're absolutely right. There is that challenge. And, you know, traditionally, if you look at how some of these things were architected with, you know, lots and lots of separate air gap systems and you know, all these sort of things. But as they've got smarter, those air gaps have sort of got broken down. And a lot of those systems now share and exist on a single platform. So you do have to make that level of security stronger. Now, there is obviously legislation around secure by design, you know, in theory that when you buy a wind turbine or a, you know, substation, it should come and it should be secure. And what happens a lot of the time is that the manufacturers of those products say, yep, we're going to ship it and we're going to, you know, we're going to enable this level of security. So we're going to enable the firewall within Linux. But the problem is that a lot of the time that gets shipped with a rule that says any to any and limited, and you know, limited IP lists, and that's not going to stop anyone. So those manufacturers need to understand that energy companies will want to embed their security products onto those environments, and I think that's something that the security industry, the manufacturers of, you know, SCADA equipment and ICS equipment have to be able to understand, because if we don't do that, we are creating slightly fragile, you know, fragile environments. And some security products just, as we said, just don't work in those environments. You know, it's because, you know, the number of interactions that an OT system has is so huge that you're never going to be able to sort of do standard EDR type things on there, or, you know, that sort of stuff. So you, as I said, you have to mitigate it in other ways. So you have to think, well, okay, so instead of EDR, we have to use NDR. You know, we do need to ring fence these environments. We do need to understand, you know, we do need intrusion prevention. We need, you know, all of these types of tools.
And we're seeing more regulatory interest in this. What have you observed from regulators across different territories?
I think the interesting thing is there's a lot of regulation, and in some countries it's so complex. So, you know, there are countries where if you're an electricity organization, there is an industry standards body, and there is maybe a state body, and then there's the government regulator, and then there's a regulator for the industry, and then, you know, and they don't always line up. So it can get confusing as to what to do there. But I think there is gradually an adoption of some fairly standard ways of doing things. So if you look at the cyber assessment framework for the UK from the NCSC, and so that's very sort of outcome driven, and that is sort of starting to be replicated in other countries. So it says good looks like this, medium looks like this, and that's the way forward. We've seen in the US, so CISA have introduced something called the Zero Trust Maturity Model, which says, okay, for the five pillars of zero trust, you know, you've got different levels of maturity, and you can see where you are, and it gives you a roadmap to the highest, you know, those highest levels. And so a lot of these things are not only regulatory tools, but they're actually also help there to sort of help organizations on that move. And we're starting to, and there's now something called Enhanced CAF that really is sort of aimed at a lot of the very, very critical. So, you know, power, so Ofgem are issuing orders to energy companies to comply with, you know, with certain things. So I think actually the UK is probably in a much better position than a lot of places. I think the one thing we need to do really is to sort of look a lot closer at what the EU are doing with NIS2, which is put much more focus on responding to the incident. Because one of the things that came out of the select committee report again was there, it's too fragmented as to where people go when there's a because there are certain organizations that are registered to be response companies, but they're quite expensive. So are they going to be interested in an NHS trust that can't pay them? Where does the NCSC fit into this? Where does National Crime Agency? So I think that some of those sorts of things need sort of fixing in the same way that they've done with NIS2 in the EU.
But we are also seeing more focus on this because of the geopolitical situation, because essentially ransomware was seen as, largely speaking, a private problem for private enterprise. But this type of thing is obviously a very attractive target. Critical infrastructure is a very attractive target to state actors rather than simply criminal groups. That's not to say the criminal groups aren't going after infrastructure. We know they are. But there's that extra leverage that can be achieved by governments if they use attacks against CNI.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, imagine, I think we could all imagine where some of these attacks are likely to come from. I think there is a deterrent option, because to a certain extent, we and our allies have very advanced capabilities to go and attack other people. So, so there is a sort of if you don't attack us, we won't attack you type of thing. But there will always be terrorist organizations, rogue bodies within governments who don't play by those rules. And so, the geopolitical information, it seems to get worse day by day, of more people blowing up more people. And the cyber consequences of that could be quite substantial. But again, I think I'm not sure there's that mindset in, bits of government, the general public, that it's as big an issue. And even within, I think there was on one of the TV programs, there was a senior general or something like this, basically saying, wars aren't won by cyber, you have to put soldiers on the ground. And, so I know there's been a lot of investment by the government and the MOD into cyber and things like that. But I still, I'm still concerned that there isn't this general public awareness of what some of those issues are. And I think until that, that is, there isn't going to be, again, the political will to sort of put the effort behind it. And it's actually very difficult, especially, if you're an NHS trust, for instance, in a smaller hospital, and you've got limited resources and limited budget, it's difficult to do that sort of thing. And I know there's some changes now in the way things work, and there's some, with the collections of trust that you get. I think the other big thing that's interesting are the regional cyber resilience centres. And I think they have a huge part to play in helping organisations to build their resiliency.
And are you seeing more willingness among CISOs to collaborate and share information? I know that does happen to an extent in certain sectors. Probably the financial and banking sector is one of those that's held up as being a good example, where people do share data and attack vector information and the like. But are we likely to see more of that, and also perhaps some better clarity as to when government is likely to help or when you're really just going to have to deal with it on your own?
I think, yes, we are. And people that I talk to other people within their industry specifically. And, and also, with these, a lot of organizations run industry user groups, and there's a lot of those types of things that go on where people can share knowledge. And there's a lot of events that are run by third parties that we go to, where the speakers are talking about what they've done, and there's that sort of willingness to share. As long as they're not sharing confidential, there's the problem is what is the confidential information, then I think there is an openness to do it. And I think as long as the forum is appropriate, I think that's a good thing. And the more we understand, the better, you know, the better things get. So yeah, absolutely. I think that sharing of information is a good thing. But I think, you know, also there is more willingness from regulators to engage with the security industry as well. And I think that's a, you know, that's a positive thing as well. So I know one of our sort of chief evangelists, John Kindervag, is involved in a number of government sort of advisory boards around the world. So, you know, so and other CISOs from other security vendors are also in that sort of space. So I think that's a good thing. That's a step forward from maybe where we were a few years ago.
And are we seeing from regulators as well as from organisations within industry that switch from a focus on defence to resilience? Is that now something that you'd say is be standard practice?
Yeah, absolutely. Everywhere you look is the guidance coming from the regulator saying, stop wasting money on trying to stop every attack and focus on trying to survive an attack. And I think because there is, you know, there's always the danger, and we've seen this for 30 odd years of security teams solving the problem that's in front of them rather than necessarily taking a strategic view and also buying the next shiny big thing. Or, you know, so there's a report I think comes out every year which says, here's the new things for next year, and here's the things from 3 years ago that no one's buying anymore that have disappeared. And so, you know, it always comes back to have a security strategy and do the basics well, you know, and then think about all the fancy, you know, fancy schmancy tools that you can buy.
And assume that you will be breached.
Assume you will be breached. And a lot of that assume breach is about assume breach and plan to do what, you know, when it happens, but also become more proactive, hunt for those, you know, find those vulnerabilities, find those risks, look for those attacks, have someone who is constantly, you know, doing threat research and understanding what the implications of these things are going to be in your business, and also plan. Plan. It used to be, you know, back in the old days, I can remember working on IBM mainframes, and up on a shelf there'd be a book which is the disaster recovery book. And, you know, when it went wrong, you got it down and everyone got in a van and went to the disaster recovery site and all this sort of stuff. And you tested it and you pulled the plug on the mainframe and to see what would happen. I think we have to sort of get back a bit to that mentality of, right, let's test this and understand what will happen when there's a problem, when there's an attack, how do we survive it? And unplugging your OT system from your IT system isn't the answer. You know, and we know that from sort of, you know, Colonial Pipeline, that just working around it, like diverting patients to a different hospital or, you know, just doing that sort of thing isn't the answer. You have to be able to maintain your services.
Trevor Deering, on the need for organisations in critical infrastructure to have a clear security strategy, to cover the basics, and to assume that a breach will happen, and of course, to plan for it. That, though, is all for this episode of Security Insights. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time, when we'll hear some of the arguments for doing away with passwords, and what we could use instead to improve identity controls and security. Until then, do catch up on past programmes on our website, securityinsights.co.uk, or subscribe and rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon, and Spotify. Thanks again for listening.